This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Jet fuel.
That's where innovation comes from. And the big companies know that, and the government knows that. But I would love to see more support. I would love to see some of the bigger companies thinking, I tell you what it is, that company around the corner is so innovative, the staff's great, they turn on a sixpence, they don't turn like an oil tanker, they don't have processes and guidelines, they just get stuff done. Why don't we bring them in to work with us?
Welcome to the Fuel Podcast, everyone. I'm your host, a Smith called Keith. The Fuel Podcast is the new business show brought to you in association with The Advertist. Tools, data and insight on thousands of UK brands and companies for efficient and targeted new business campaigns. If you're an advertising, PR, digital marketing brand or communications agency, you need a subscription to The Advertist, recommended by the best in the business of new business. If you need to make your customer acquisition campaign stick, get a subscription to The Advertist. It's the most cost-effective, powerful and inspirational way to find new clients. Just give the team a call on 0203 356 3717 or email hello@theadvertist.com for a free, no-obligation trial to find out why the experts recommend The Advertist for agency new business growth. How to zig when everyone's zagging. We cannot become what we want by remaining what we are, said Max Dupree. He was the CEO of the Herman Miller Furniture Company. And this edition of Fuel is all about using the current confusion in the business world to carve yourself an advantage. We talk to an expert in motivation and business mentorship about how SMEs can use the tools that we all have at our disposal to gain market share, develop brand strategies, and build our own unique personal brand. But before we embark on another broadcasting odyssey, here's Jeremy Davis with another slightly off-centre look at the world of new business.
Last week's frenzy, the great GameStop bubble appears to have burst this week, with shares down more than 80% from their peak value, according to the New York Times. The last big controversy GameStop was embroiled in was the abrupt disappearance of its Buck the Bunny advertising mascot. Buck was a foul-mouthed white rabbit. Much like his Alice in Wonderland doppelganger, Buck was late. In his case, late to the brand mascot party. I can't think of many retailers recently that have used brand mascots in their ads. HMV's Nipper the dog has always maintained his dignified silence, forever sitting by that gramophone listening out for his master's voice rather than getting dragged into the undignified business of flogging records. In fact, the most recent brand mascot advert from a major retailer that I can think of is from Woolworths, which dates the concept somewhat. Woolly and Worth, their sheep and sheepdog pairing, appeared in an advert with Rolf Harris, which really hasn't aged well. Fittingly, Buck the Bunny was a video game character who appeared in a series of commercials featuring Mario-style platform games in which he jumped on baddies and, more importantly, collected coins, signifying the kind of value for money that could be attained by shopping at GameStop. Unlike Mario or Sonic the Hedgehog, though, Buck swore like a trooper. Or perhaps more importantly, like a gamer, because everyone knows that stereotypes in advertising sell. As bunnies in advertising go, Buck was very much the Mr. Wimpy to the Duracell bunnies Ronald McDonald, although he did manage to transcend advertising, unlike Ronald, who allegedly missed out on a part in Super Size Me because the censors felt that his oversized red shoes might be his way of compensating for something. Buck made the leap into broader media with his own mobile game, The Coin of Destiny, in which Buck is a freelancer waiting for an invoice to get paid. I'm joking, of course, and for all you freelancers out there, if you are being paid in coins, you really need to look at your pricing structure. Buck was phased out of GameStop's advertising. He has his own Facebook page, but it was last updated in 2012. This being America, his demise prompted a level of conspiracy theory comparable to the assassination of JFK. I actually came across a Reddit thread on the subject, which felt pleasingly postmodern, considering that Reddit was where the whole Wall Street Bets thing got started. I had to leave it there, though, before I got sucked too far down that particular internet rabbit hole.
Okay, it's time for the main event. We've kept you waiting long enough. Ian Farrah, as you'll hear in a minute, was introduced to me by influencer and social media maven Mae King Sang, who was on the show a few weeks ago. She said I needed to meet Ian because he's a great example of how to create a personal brand, which in this business economy is absolutely vital if we're to stand out in this world of content sharing. Gone are the days when we could hide behind the skirts of our employer brand. We're always in a one-to-one dialogue now, so it's super important that you create distinction and do something memorable. So here's me and Ian Farrah chewing the fat. And I just wish it could have been over a nice curry on Ocean Road with a few cold ones. Our new business podcast, Rocket Ship, continues on its upward trajectory as we uncover yet more of the unusual suspects in the world of sales and marketing. Now, for this one, I have to thank Mae King Sang for putting me in touch with my next guest. I should have known she knows all the best people, and it's because of her that this show's going to be a cracker. My guest this week runs an end-to-end sales and marketing consultancy called Far North. As the name suggests, it's not based in London, but from his HQ in South Shields, Ian Farrah really shows company leaders how to do their own marketing while producing, developing, and executing sales and marketing plans for business-to-business businesses around the country. He's a celebrity in his own right because before the blockbuster lockdown, Lockdown 2, Return of the Hobby, and Lockdown 3, Bojo and Dom's Bogus Adventure, he was busy putting points on his Travelodge loyalty card with speaking engagements around the country. But that's all changed now, so we've got him. And what a treat you're in for, because Ian is not your ordinary sales and marketing fare. He spends all of his time advising those hundreds of thousands of companies that exist outside of the FTSE and actually drive Britain's economy. He's known for a no-nonsense, bullshit-free approach to helping companies organise their communications and new business. Now, here in the US, there's a bloke called Marcus Lemonis who owns hundreds of very successful businesses, but his celebrity comes from his passion for right-siding companies that have lost their way or in need of some expert advice, and it's a similar case this week. So sure, we'll pick his brains for some gems of wisdom that you can apply to your own business, but if you know me well, you'll know I like to do things slightly differently, and this week, I'm also delving into the world of philanthropy, and the man to guide me through this karma-driven approach to new business is none other than Mr. Ian Farrah. Welcome, Ian.
Wow, that is one heck of an introduction. You must put some time into that, my friend.
Everything is just down to the last detail.
Right at the top of it, though, you said something that stuck out. You said unusual, and I couldn't quite catch. Was it unusual guests or unusual world of sales and marketing?
Unusual suspects.
Unusual. Right, okay, I'll take that. That's fine.
You're not one of the usual suspects, you know, that we would pick on. Because
nah,
we normally,
we don't want to be usual, do we? Nah.
We like to do things slightly differently. But so how are you anyway?
Yeah, good. It's obviously strange times. I don't know.
You're clearly showing the strain if you've agreed to come on this show.
I thought I was going to say clearly show the strain judging by your face, because we're on video together right now, and I do look a little bit tired. I'm good, you know, I feel really good actually from a business point of view. We're helping loads of businesses recover, so it's very rewarding. And there's lots of government grants out there actually for specific local authorities
right
here in the UK. So yeah, we've been brought on board to help them recover, which is just dead rewarding. Really, really good.
Good. Excellent. Well, I mentioned right at the top of the show that you were on the speaking circuit, and because not only has the pandemic affected the events industry, but it's also kind of driven a bus right through those that make a living from speaking engagements. I mean, how have you managed to pivot to a kind of an online existence?
How have I not, Keith? Because everything's online, isn't it? It's funny because I guess when it first happened, like March time, I think I was on holiday. It felt like a holiday.
Right.
Like every night was just, let's crack the wine open. And then after 2 weeks, I thought, got to rein this in, surely. And then I think the world kind of did the same and thought, right, this is not going away. Let's start taking things online. So people are actually reaching out to me and saying, look, you know, that conference is actually going to go ahead. We need to just keep things ticking over. So we're going to go online. So yeah, it just naturally went. I'm doing loads of training online as well.
Right.
And quite selfishly, I love it. because I'm not staying in hotels, I'm not traveling very far, I'm just doing it right now from my HQ. So yeah, it's worked out well.
Oh, fantastic. Well, so obviously thriving under these conditions. And I mean, I guess that you know, the pandemic forced us all to kind of engage the right side of our brains a bit. What's the most sort of innovative approach to coaching and teaching that you've seen or heard about? I mean, are there any things that that people in our hemisphere should be thinking about?
I'm going to talk about something I do called CarbAware here. And CarbAware was something that I brought into play about 2 years ago.
Cool.
CarbAware means seize the way. So I've got that domain, carbaware.com.
Spell it.
And it's a carp as in carpe diem.
Oh,
so
okay.
C-A-R-P-E, way, carpe way. And what I do is I take people out into nature once a month, and we have a kind of talking, walking, leadership coaching day. So there's 12 of us normally. Right. I keep it to a small number of 12, and we go walking in the hills, and we kind of share our experiences as leaders. We share any troubles, issues, that sort of thing. And it's a really trusted environment. Kind of what happens in the room stays in the room. Well, what happens in the hills stays in the hills. And I love that. But unfortunately, during this pandemic, you know, we could only see six, I think it was, at one point outside.
Right.
So then there were six of us would go walking, and it's hard to pick the right six. And then now it's only one. So I've still tried to keep that going. So in terms of trying to be a little bit different, it's having outside meetings.
Yeah.
You know, going outside and meeting people and walking along the beach together, because that's something we can do. We can take an hour out to exercise or so. So, you know, let's double that up and take a walk. So I really enjoyed that.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds like a fantastic idea. And because you're on the coast as well, aren't you?
I am indeed, yeah. And I used to surf quite a lot back in the day, but this North Sea is super cold.
Well, I couldn't do it surfing now as well.
Yeah, looking back, I think, why did I do that?
Fantastic. Well, one of the most kind of frustrating things, certainly in terms of business development from my side of things, you know, is that for a significant number of months, the prospects and clients have kind of been holding out and hoping for a return to what they were sort of kind of comfortable with. And we did sort of touch on this in a conversation we had earlier. But I mean, do you think we're actually going to bounce back, or do you think we're headed for a new kind of baseline now?
I think we are bouncing back. I think we'll bounce back very differently, though. I mean, yeah, I think a lot of us are in our little bubbles. I am, for sure, in terms of what we do in our businesses. So if you're in hospitality, retail, you know, pubs, clubs, restaurants, you're going to be hit. You know, beauty, chauffeurs, hairdressers. My son's a barber. He's sitting around watching Netflix all day. But with me, I'm so, so busy. So, you know, our companies have bounced back, but there is a number of sectors who, of course, are still waiting. But the time will come. The time will come if they can hold out. And yeah, that's what some of these grants and loans are for. But I won't get on my soapbox, but here in the UK, obviously, we have had a number of, well, 3 million that you might have heard of that have been kind of fell through the cracks,
yeah,
from the Chancellor's support. You know, so there's a lot of companies out there who haven't had much support. And I'm really fearful of not just them companies going under, but their mental health as well.
Right.
They will be struggling right now. So hopefully we will all bounce back. And when I say we all, I mean all companies, but we are going to lose a lot along the way.
Right.
And I hope it's just companies and not people that we lose. So
right.
I don't mean to bring it down, but you know, we are under massive pressure here.
No, it's understandable. I mean, there's a lot of it about at the moment. I think, you know, this is almost like the sort of the stages of grief that people go through, is that after a while you begin to sort of take stock and it suddenly sinks in that this is the reality. So yeah, it's good. But I mean, optimistically, I mean, I wanted just to sort of dig back slightly, because I mean, I don't know you that well, but what I have learned from you, I think, and learned of you, is that you're a very kind of optimistic kind of person. And I mean, what have you always been like this? I mean, what were you like at school? Were you kind of an enthusiastic learner?
Absolutely atrocious, Keith. Absolutely atrocious. Like lots of entrepreneurs as well, you know. The studies and the statistics of entrepreneurs with a degree level, you know, not many are. You know, it tends to be people like me. You know, I struggled at school. I didn't like it. I didn't like putting a box. I didn't like the, you know, 9 to 5 kind of, you learn, you sit down there and learn about Henry the Eighth. I'm just not bothered. I'm really not bothered about all that kind of stuff. And I kind of really fell into my niche in the maybe early 30s, actually, right. Because when I left school, my father said that, you know, there's money in engineering. So I went into engineering and I was the worst engineer in the world. So, you know, I mentioned my son was a barber. For me, it's all about getting our children to follow their dreams, and it doesn't always have to be money led. You know, the money can come down the line. You don't need money at 19.
That's different from our parents, because our parents were always kind of, you know, you need to have a profession. You need to, it needs to be a sort of a 30-year, you know, sort of career history and stuff. So, you know, yeah, I see there's, it's nice to have a big difference like that, you know, where you're kind of actively encouraging them to do the right thing rather than just the thing that you have to do. But so what attracted you to the world of sales and marketing then? You said you were a bad engineer. So what got you... What got you into sales and marketing?
It's actually sales and marketing. Engineering did get me into that, actually, interestingly enough, because I'm a huge fan of mentorship.
Right.
And this is in the mid-90s, maybe, when I was an engineer. And my boss, I mean, I work for a large blue-chip company. I work for Rolls-Royce. I was a Rolls-Royce apprentice,
I've heard of
which looks great on my CV when I was a boy. but don't ask me anything about engineering. I just said to my gaffer one day, I just said, look, you know, during an appraisal, he said, what do you want, Ian? I said, I want your job.
That's a
and just was this bit of a weird
classic.
Pause. And he said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, look, I don't want to be operational, head down in a technical role. I'm rubbish at it. You know, I don't want to look at all these particular, you know, equations and stuff. I want your job. I want to lead. I want to manage. And I want to speak to people and use my skills. So he said, okay. He said, I want my boss's job. He said, let's get you my job. And then let's work on me getting my gaffer's job.
Sounds like a mutiny.
Yeah, it was a nice route. So that job was a lot around people, a lot around communication skills, and that's where my skills were, you know, talking to people, you know, talking through issues, problems, pulling things together, brainstorming and that sort of stuff. And that took me into sales and marketing, because what happened was they started putting me in front of clients because I could talk.
Yeah.
And the technical team were very techie. So it was wheel Ian in and he'll just grease the wheels a little bit, you know, use his humor and stuff, and it'll be all right. So that took me into sales and marketing, actually. I never really thought about being a salesperson. And I don't really see myself as a salesperson either.
So, I mean, what was behind the sort of the start of the Far North business? I mean, what was the genesis to that idea?
Yeah, I'd sat on a board for a dozen years or so. And across that time, I'd been involved with other suppliers, such as marketing companies and lead generation companies, sales and that sort of stuff. And what I realized is that they didn't really understand the end-to-end of a business. You know, a web designer was, I mean, no disrespect, I'm going to massively generalize here. Sorry, web designers. But they really know web design inside and out. But do they really understand lead generation? Do they really understand sales and sales pipelines and process and that sort of stuff? And I found that the ones I was dealing with didn't. And when I left that company, I thought, you know what it is? There's something missing here. Sales and marketing should be hand in glove. The marketing and sales teams shouldn't be prickly and have friction like these do. They should be actually be together. And what if I could start a company that had sales and marketing in mind as a holistic approach? You know, and it worked. It works dead well.
And it's, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, we're coming across more and more now, is that, you know, the one thing has to, they have to coexist. They have to have a symbiotic relationship in order to, you know, to function properly. And I mentioned at the top of the show there, that chap Marcus Lemonis, and I don't know whether you're familiar with him, but he's got a show in the US where he basically steps in and sort of rescues businesses that are sort of heading down the wrong path, or the sales aren't working out and stuff. Because and his fascination is with small businesses or sort of the growing businesses, because, you know, really, and I sort of hope you'll sort of agree with me on this, but, you know, the 99% of businesses that support the economy are the small entrepreneurs. They're the sort of small, you know, 1 to 50 employee type size businesses. And, you know, I mean, and they haven't always got the big budgets and the ability. They're not a role Rolls-Royce. You know, they don't have the ability to, you know, to waste money on sort of various sort of marketing sort of opportunities. So, I mean, what are the kind of basic rules of sales and marketing for SMEs? Do they have to sort of keep looking at things like websites, podcasts and TikTok, etc.?
I smile, you know, because I start any of my keynotes or any of my training with them. If you forget about sales and concentrate on relationships, the numbers will take care of itself. So for me, it's very much about relationship game. You know, it's a bit like you reaching out, Keith, and me being on your show here. Thanks so much anyway for that. And your audience and your tribe. We're creating relationships. We're creating content. We're chatting, hopefully dropping some value for each other without actually asking for anything in return. We're just right. creating relationships, you know, and I really do believe we're in an age now where content is king. And we don't like these cold reach outs on LinkedIn anymore, or these, you know, these spammy cold emails, this scattergun approach. We really just want to have a good time and create relationships with integrity and authenticity. And that's not, you know, those words aren't dirty. No. They're just overused by marketers. You know, authenticity is fine, you know. And we've got people like Brené Brown with Data Lead, is Brené's book. You know, she talks about vulnerability and shedding the armor. And that's great, especially from a leadership point of view as well. Heart on your sleeve kind of stuff. And that's what I love to do. If you look at some of my content, my kids are involved. I'm very open about my mental health, my fitness, whatever drives me. So yeah, I do think the smaller business has really something cool to offer, and it's authenticity. It's right. the journey. You know, people don't buy my products or my services. They buy me, they buy my team, they buy the fun we have, and they want to be a part of that. So share the hell out of it.
That's very reassuring, actually, because, I mean, one of the things that's happening in the advertising and marketing world is that, you know, now because everybody's stuck behind a screen, that, you know, it's kind of leveled the playing field in terms of sort of big brands being able to work with smaller, tighter organizations that they wouldn't normally be able to work with. So, you know, like you say, yeah, I guess the sort of that's where your personality will always win through.
Dead right. I'll just pick up a point on that if you don't mind.
Good.
You mentioned something really good, which was about, you know, the backbone and these micro businesses and SMEs. That's where innovation comes from.
Yes.
And the big companies know that. And the government knows that. But I would love to see more support. I would love to see some of the bigger companies thinking, I tell you what it is, that company around the corner is so innovative, the staff's great, they turn on a sixpence, they don't turn like an oil tanker, they don't have processes and guidelines, they just get stuff done. Why don't we bring them in to work with us? Oh, but they're scared. There's not enough of that going on.
See, now you're talking my language, because I was talking the other day about, you know, the fact that that you know, people were talking about breaking up the monopolies of TikTok or Twitter and Facebook and you know, the like. And really, companies like that got to be that size because they acquire small innovative businesses. You know, so I mean, there is a degree, and I absolutely buy into what you're saying there about, you know, the idea that you have to encourage the grassroots organizations, the smaller, more nimble organizations. You have to keep them going because that's what the bigger organizations feed off, you know, in order to make themselves successful. So yeah, that's a very good point, and you know, very well made. Thank you. Now, interestingly, I don't know whether you're familiar with this, but I follow a podcast, and it's a book series as well called Freakonomics. And it basically looks at the numbers behind certain popular rules to see if they really do stand up to scrutiny. And recently, one of their investigations looked at the world of TV advertising, and which is quite relevant, really, because we're recording this kind of almost on the cusp of the world's most expensive annual TV slot, Super Bowl. And I'm not going to go into it too much. I'll just quote a lady called Anna Tuchman, who's the Associate Professor of Marketing at Northwestern University in the USA. And she said that basically TV advertising is 15 to 20 times less effective than conventional wisdom says. Now, far be it from me to kind of diss the industry that I worship so much, but I mean, what's your view on why TV advertising is still considered to be the ultimate marketing move?
That's a really interesting one, because you're going to get people talking about Netflix and Amazon Prime and, you know, all these, we've got Now TV and all these streaming services, and then people saying, who watches adverts? Surely we just click through them. Surely we watch on demand. And obviously you mentioned the Super Bowl, which is the big one that everybody kind of wants to be around. Honestly, television for me, it's something that I haven't really bothered with for a long, long time now.
Right.
I just don't. I binge Netflix series, but I hardly even put the television on. So it's a really good point, and I don't even know what the stats are or how you would even gauge it really, because they just take a snippet and then magnify it by a number. But I've got no idea. I certainly wouldn't be advertising on television if I could.
No, exactly. So I mean, that being the case, I mean, I think you're sort of not in the minority there. So I mean, what do you think are the dominant channels now? Where's it good to be seen in marketing terms?
It's funny because you mentioned Freakonomics earlier on there, and I did a bit of a wry smile, because quite often when if I was to pick up someone's phone now and look at their podcast list, there's probably going to be the big ones in there, okay? There's going to be Mr. Rogan. There's going to be, I don't know, Peter Crouch. There's going to be a BBC one. You know, there's lots in there that we know of, a Gary Vee maybe. What about the indie casters, right? What about us, the solo casters who are reaching out to people, doing the research, recording the audio, editing the audio, putting it up to our channels, doing the social media, doing all the graphics? And we're doing that alone or with a very small team. Oh, we don't have a huge budget behind us, likes of these people. So when people talk about, you know, that the bigger podcast, I kind of cringe inside a bit, because I just think, look at us. Look what we're doing out here. And there's so much value as well. We're not here to sell programs or buy our trilogy of books or come and see me speak and pay $200 and then you can go on the 2000 VIP program. We're here because it's our passion, right? We're not trying to sell anything. We're here to have fun, you know, create relationships, expand our network and add value. So I'm banging on my soapbox here, aren't I? When we look at some of these magazine articles, here's the top 10 podcasts. It isn't the top 10 podcasts. It's the podcasts that put a bunch of money behind it to become the top 10, to put all the advertising in there, or to actually pay people in the Far East to listen, download, review, and subscribe. Rant over.
Fantastic. God, it's very true, actually. I mean, it's funny because I don't regard the BBC or you know, sort of the big broadcasters, I don't regard them as podcasters, because podcasting to me is like pirate radio used to be in the 60s. You know, it's the idea of doing it for yourself and it being very much a cottage industry, you're sort of stumbling your way through as you go through. And I mean, I think that it's an interesting world that we're now living in, because this is now, I think, we're the sixth estate, I think, given the ranking of media now. It's an interesting area, and I'm glad you brought that up as well. So you've had plenty of experience of speaking to people. You said you go out on these walks with other leaders. In your mind, what makes a great leader? What are the kind of the ingredients for a great leader?
That's really interesting. I can answer this two ways. I can tell you what I've saw in leaders, in traits, or I can tell you what makes a great leader. Because there's lots of leaders out there, right? Okay, everybody listen right now. Sit back, close your eyes, and picture that boss who was the real tyrant, okay? Who, like, when you came in at like 9:02 and say, "Afternoon, Ian," and be like, "Oh, come on, man, give me a break." You know, those have specific traits as leaders. I want to love and care for my team. I actually want to love them. I want to know everything about them. I want to know about their families. I want to know about their kids. I want to make sure that I'm an integral part of their lives. You know, we are paying mortgages here. We are allowing people to buy cars and go on holidays. So we're an integral part of their lives. I don't want to be a tyrant. You know, so for me, it's about culture. That my business was culture first, turnover second. And actually what I thought about was, if I create a good culture, the turnover will actually be better. You know, if I'm going to rule with an iron fist, people aren't going to be as efficient. They're going to leave at 5 on the dot because, you know, you tell me off and I'll leave when I'm coming in 2 minutes past nine. So I'm going to leave at five on the dot. So culture for me, you know, so that's what makes a great leader is to actually love your team.
Wow. That's, you see, that goes back to what you said earlier as well about, you know, sort of the idea of, you know, of not putting the profit up front, but actually, you know, the culture as the number one thing. And I think it's, you know, it's certainly coming through now. It certainly seems to be more prevalent now. So, I mean, OK, so these leaders, they come to you, they ask for your expertise and stuff. I mean, in your opinion, I mean, what do leaders need to look out for as the kind of signs that their business needs a review of its sales or its marketing? I mean, obviously, apart from the fact we're not selling anything, that's probably a number one, I would say. But number two, beyond that, I mean, what are the kind of common symptoms of a business that needs to take a look at its sales and marketing?
It's a big question. There's a number of things in there. So dare I say the word pivot? Can we say that now? Is that a swear word? We've used it quite a lot. You know, lots of businesses have pivoted. But lots of customer segments have unfortunately died off or reduced. So, you know, back in the day, my grandfather, I don't know about yours, Keith, he was a miner.
Okay, right.
Okay, so if I was making mining cobbler's shoes back then, I would have made a mint. But now if I'm making miner's shoes or hat picks or whatever, I'm not going to be able to sell any. So stuff changes, right? So if I'm dealing with manufacturers, I could deal with renewable energy. It's doing well. Automotive sector, doing well. Precision engineer for medical sectors, doing well. So some of these sectors are really buoyant. So if you're a manufacturer, these are the things that I'd be trying to watch out for is what sectors do I really need to get into? You know, what networking events do I need to get into? What quality procedures do I need to make sure I've got to be able to tap into them? Because some of those customer segments can die off. And if your eggs are all in one basket, I'd be really worried right now. So it's about making sure that you're kind of spreading your risk across. So when people come to us for sales and marketing issues, it's because they've done that. They've gone very niche, which I love niches, right? But I like having a multiple. Right. Do you say niches actually? Multiple niches.
I don't know. Everybody in America says niche, but I still say niche, and I think it is niche.
There's riches and niches, you guys say over there.
It's a French word, isn't it? It's for a little outcome.
Yeah. So it's about having a number for me rather than just having one, because you know there is a risk that might go, and that's what we saw during the pandemic. And you know, we've seen some restaurants, for instance, now starting to do delivery, home delivery. Great. Why weren't you doing that before? You know, so it's about kind of maybe looking to the future and thinking, I don't want to get caught out on this. You know, where can we do?
So do you think that moving forward that a sales and marketing plan will always need to include a degree of flexibility in terms of being able to sort of re-engineer where you're going, you know, and to sort of be able to pivot? There you go. I said it as well.
I think it goes back to that thing I was talking about at the top of the conversation about Far North. My company is that sales and marketing are hand in glove.
Yeah.
So if you've got a sales team or a sales strategy that are purely sales focused, you're kind of missing out really, because if you look at it, you've got a social media plan, you've got a marketing strategy, you've got a sales strategy that dovetails into that. So actually, they all should be speaking to each other.
Right. Of course. Yes. I mean, it stands to reason, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But So in your role as a public speaker, I mean, and obviously you've got a great deal of experience in that sort of area, and also in the sort of marketing business. And now we're all stuck behind our desks looking at computers. I mean, and specifically with the agency world, which is notorious for its desire to push out the boat in terms of presentations. I mean, what's your advice for any agencies sort of learning to live a life on video calls? I mean, is there a difference in how you present on video as opposed to how you present as a person?
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? Let me take it this way. Do you think you've dressed differently since last year in front of clients?
Well, I'm wearing a lot more sweatpants these days, but... my athleisure wear has expanded, but
what I meant by that is because we're using things like Zoom and Teams and that kind of thing, is that we're actually in each other's houses, yes. bedrooms, lounges. You know, I've been delivering and. People's partners have came in with a cup of tea. Their children have burst in like that famous BBC Sky News, whatever it was, interview. And the intimacy is much better. And for me, the reason why I said, are you dressing a little bit differently? You know, walking in with a suit on and being quite formal and shaking hands when we're allowed, it's actually, I like the fact that it's eased a little bit and we're actually getting... We're understanding that we're people, you know, we all pull our jeans on one leg at a time. We're in it for our kids, our families and hobbies and this sort of stuff. And we can lose that little bit of business edge, that buzzword bingo. So, you know, in terms of presenting stuff, I'm a real fan of just being yourself. And the worry that people have about that is, oh, what if they don't like me? You know, what if they don't work with us? Then great.
Yeah.
Because it's a good filter. That means they're not for you. So I would just be you, dress the way you want within reason, right? And ensure you'll attract good clients and good people that are a good fit for you, you know?
You do you.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. Yeah, it's nice, nice tip there as well. But now you mentioned something a while back that I wanted to pick up on when you were talking about you know, sort of each of us having a personal brand, which I found very interesting based on what you've just said now. So, I mean, what are the kind of things that define a personal brand as far as you're concerned?
Well, these are good questions, Keith. Where do you get these from?
Well, I think about them a bit, you know.
So, you know, I'm big on personal branding. And if you hear me speak, I'll always say that I'm Ian Farrow Limited.
Right.
I work for a company, but the company's me first and foremost. And that's not being egotistical or anything like that, because the company actually benefits from that, because we all buy from each other. You know, we know that people buy from people, and also people buy from people they know, like, and trust.
Right.
So if you get that personal branding thing across and they know who you are, who your values are, we'll work together so much easier. So from a personal brand point of view, I would take a pen and paper right now if you're listening and just take a few minutes to write down, what are your personal values? What do you stand for? You know, and for me, it's transparency, honesty, communication with clients. That's what I uphold. You know, that's what I enjoy. Once you understand those values, then you live through them. And again, if the employee doesn't like them or your clients don't like them, then they're not for you, you know. So live through your values for me in terms of personal branding. Often people stand out with a personal brand. I've got friends who wear like big hats and cravats and stuff. I often wear waistcoats with a pocket watch. You know, everyone has their own little thing.
How very stylish.
Yeah, everyone has their own thing. But yeah, you know, you could really just start by looking at what you stand for.
Right. And I mean, you've been doing the sort of podcasting, vlogging and live streaming thing for quite some time. I mean, you know, compared to us noobs and stuff. But I mean, how long exactly have you been doing it? And when did you spot this as an opportunity?
Well, considering that you've got all the gear, right, you look amazing and you're saying you're a noob and I'm in a little corner here. Right, with little tiles to try to make it sound a bit better.
Oh, fantastic.
You know, maybe 5 or 6 years I started. Right. And the reason being is I loved internet radio. Well, actually, I'll dial it back for a second. I love great conspiracy theories, underground bases, aliens, UFOs. I'm all over all over this stuff, right? I have been since a boy. You know, gave me a little book with a Loch Ness Monster in or something. I was hooked.
Lovely.
And then I found Art Bell on Coast to Coast Radio via old dial-up when I first got an internet connection. We used to dial it up. And then we found internet radio and I could listen to the likes of Art Bell through internet radio. And then from that love, I fell into podcasting. The reason I got into podcasting was quite interesting, because I give myself a goal. I'm a huge goal setter. I decided I was going to listen to the top 100 books as recognized by the BBC. So I started cheating a bit. I started listening to audiobooks, you know. I mean, have you seen Moby Dick? It's like a doorstop.
I know.
You know, and the classics, you know, getting through them were just, ugh. And Dostoevsky, you know, it's tough going. So I started to listen to them on audiobooks. And then I thought, well, you know, I love internet radio. I love audiobooks. And then I found the purple icon on the phone, which was podcasts, Apple Podcasts. And then started listening and I thought, hey, you know, I love this. Maybe I could do some of this. I just started Far North. I wanted to document my journey into entrepreneurship. So I just began, and that's it. 5 or 6 years later, 200 and something episodes through.
Wow. And it's, I mean, I have to say, I mean, everything, I've, you know, have a look at the, I'd advise anybody have a look at the content on your site, because there's something about the fact that it, like we were saying earlier about the production values. Now, I know that you say that you generate a lot of it yourself and stuff like that, but that doesn't mean you don't put a very professional looking spin on everything. I mean, it all looks like it's been created, you know, with a great deal of care and attention. And I think that comes through. And, you know, like you were saying about the podcasting business as well, that I think if people put the effort in, that it comes through and people enjoy listening to it at the end of the day. And that's really what it's about. We're still in the entertainment business, really.
Yeah, I think even just having a good microphone, you know,
absolutely, yeah.
You know, the way you've dealt with my team, Keith, fantastic. Everything's there. The calendar invites, you know, what we're going to talk about. We had a preamble last week. You know, it's just making sure that everything is on point, because you know yourself, you listen to podcasts. If a podcast listens like it's been amplified through a hamster's cage, and you're just like, this is, I'm done, I'm out of here. You know, see, people have got a very short attention span right now. So yeah, you've got to make these things sound good.
And I mean, do you think that this, the podcasting, vlogging, live streaming, all that sort of stuff, that family of broadcasting, do you think that is now an integral part of the sort of business marketing sort of armory now?
100%. If you're not doing it, you're really missing a trick. And I think a lot of people will say, first of all, I don't know what to do. I don't know what content to do. You know, I could list 10 off the top of my head that you could do. You could tell me a teaching part, a how-to guide, your top 10 tips on social media, a day in the life, what you've just discovered today, your observations, current affairs, media, your journey. You know, there's loads you can do. But the first thing is, what am I talking about?
Yeah.
Who's going to listen to me? You know?
Getting back onto the authenticity thing, which I think is a sort of a big factor in a lot of stuff that you do. I mean, it's very much about what you do and what you say. You know, that, and I often quote that old poem, a man of words and not of deeds is like a garden full of weeds. I don't know whether you're familiar with that, but it's a great little saying, but not so much of a wonderful poem, I have to say, because it ends with a line, you're dead and dead indeed, which is slightly disconcerting. But we had a chat a week or so ago, and I was all ready to have a sort of big discussion about sales and marketing, and you know, obviously because that's what we do, but our conversation went off on a slightly different path, and this was what I wanted to take some time to cover, because it's something that I could tell you're very, very clearly passionate about, and that's volunteering and brand karma. And you told me a while back you believe that good brings good, not necessarily in terms of direct revenue, but in terms of kind of well-being and personal growth and stuff. Just fill me in. Give me again the idea behind this book you've got. I think it's fantastic.
I don't know where I don't know where it initially started, but I know what I do is I often give myself these 100 or 101 tasks to do, like the books that I mentioned earlier on. What I thought about was, could I volunteer 101 times? And what I thought about is that if I'm volunteering, why don't I write about it to inspire others? So once I'd volunteered a couple of times, I wrote a little blog article about it. And then I thought, what if I compiled a book with all of these blog articles in them that someone could just sit and pick up like a coffee table style and just flick to number 79 and, you know, read about me wrapping Christmas presents in a shopping mall, right? And the interesting bit is that every kind of article is about a charity, and a charity is often founded by somebody with a why. You know, so I sit on the board of a charity for the last few years, and the parents founded the charity because they lost two boys to a particular disease. So now I can write about the Charlie and Carla Foundation. Now I can write about Grace House. Now I can write about these charities and like kind of give them a little bit of like recognition for what they do. But along the way, I'm meeting so many people and enjoying what I do. And karma, as you touched upon before, is it's not something I do to receive, but I've received so much from doing it. I've met so many fantastic people from volunteering. So my thought was, if I create a book with 101 volunteering sessions in it and somebody read it and was inspired to volunteer once, twice, 10 times, my book could inspire thousands to volunteer, and volunteering is the backbone of our country. Without our volunteers, we'd be nowhere. So that was kind of where it came from. It was a bit of an accident, really.
Well, I was going to say, let's just get something straight here. I mean, you didn't start this with the idea of, well, if I put something out there, I'll get something back. This was never a transactional idea. It was just you wanted to just volunteer. And so, what did you do? Did you just like select 100 different things? Or how did you find out about them all? Where do you start?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I decided at first, I think I ran a half marathon for the foundation that I sit on.
Right.
And I just put that out there. And then I met somebody and I went on a beach cleanup with bags and stuff and tidied the beach up. And then I met a chap on that who had adopted a section of moorland in Northumberland here in the UK. And when you adopt it, you get a high-vis vest and you get some tools, you get some like cutting shears and a spade and stuff. And I went up on the Northumberland moors and we dug out trenches so the water would drain down, and we cut all the hay. When people go for a walk, right, along footpaths, you don't realize people actually cut those down. And as volunteers,
okay,
because if not, the privets and everything will just grow over.
Just grows over.
So we cut all that back, and then I thought, well, this is interesting, and it just kind of led on. So what I discovered was there was a bit of a mix there. There was a mix of working with charities, doing some environmental stuff, but then doing some physical challenges as well. So it's like a mix, really.
So wow. So I mean, did you what's the craziest one that you've done?
The interesting wrapping presents was interesting, right? In the shopping mall, because it was like a couple of days before Christmas, and you get all these guys running up to us and going, "Here, mate, I've just bought this perfume, like, and I didn't know how to wrap it." So I'll be like, "Right, look, just put some money in that pot, and I'll sort it out. Like, what colour does she like?"
So
well, I didn't ask, son, like gold or something.
People were just bringing you things, and you'd wrap them up.
So I was quickly wrapping like perfume and scarves, and like I had all these different colour papers with bows on and stuff.
Oh, man.
And that was quite funny. It was good crack. But I guess the wild one was the boxing one that I still kind of think about quite frequently, because I really trained hard for about 6 months, training 2, 3, 4 times a day sometimes. Lost a load of weight, got myself really lean, and, you know, got very addicted to the feeling of feeling fit and getting in the ring and challenging myself. So yeah, that was probably the most impact, I think.
And so who did you go up against in the fight?
It was a number of different martial arts clubs got together, and the coaches just matched us off against like height and weight and ability. So I didn't actually know who I was going to fight until the day before when they announced it. So I fought a guy who was about my height, but he was a heavy guy. He was a real heavy guy, which worked two ways.
How'd you get
if on? He hits me, it's going to hurt. But if I hit him in the stomach, he hasn't got much muscle there to stop it. So it was an interesting bout.
How'd he get on?
Well, yeah, you know, I took him down a few times.
Fantastic. A boxer, and he's a boxer, a fighter?
He was a martial artist, yeah. So,
wow. Yeah. Oh, good for you. Wow, that's fantastic.
So, but we raised £8,000 that night, and it wasn't really about like who wins or who loses. Everybody who got in the ring was the winner. And we decided to have no contest. We decided a law. My hand was risen in the air. It was like they were all draws, if you like,
right?
Because people got in that ring, and unless you've got in the ring before, you know, don't think it's not easy. You know, someone punching you in the face is not easy.
No.
You know, Mike Tyson famously said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Which is on our website, I have to say. Yeah. That's the quote on our website.
Yeah, cool. And that's applicable to everything in life, isn't it? So, yeah, when you get hit in the face, it's nasty.
Well, seeing as we spend most of our lives trying to avoid that sort of thing happening, and then to volunteer to actually step into a ring for that to happen, that's fantastic. So have you done them all now, or have you got more to go?
No, I've got more to go, Keith, and I think the pandemic's really put pay to that. So one way I can do it is I've hosted a couple of online kind of remote seminars and parties and emceed things online for a couple of charities. And then every Sunday I run 10 kilometres for a different charity each week.
Wow.
So yeah, that's all I can do really up to now.
Wow. That's amazing. I was, because I was watching that Eddie Izzard doing his marathon running.
Yeah.
That's at 26 in 26 days or something. It's 26 marathons. Unbelievable.
He's an absolute machine. And that's all about recovery, you know. If your body can recover like that. And you know, there's people out there like Sir David Goggins and stuff who's quite inspirational, who talks about, you know, getting out there and running. And I often think that your mind is so much stronger than your body. You know, your body wants to stop, doesn't it? And actually I keep telling myself, like, no, you've got, you could run for another 5 hours if you wanted, you just don't want to. So just dig in and do it. And Eddie Izzard must have that mental strength, because he's absolutely inspirational.
It is, fair play to Eddie Izzard for that, because that is it's a phenomenal feat. But you're right though that I mean, I dabble in the world of running, but there is a point that very soon whenever I start is that, you know, the mind is saying, okay, you've had enough now, you've done it, you know, but you can't, or sorry, your body's telling you, but your mind. Actually, if you can think your way through it and switch off for a bit, it's amazing how much, you know, how much longer you can go for. So that's fantastic. So when's all this going to come to a completion and your book going to be ready?
I think I'm going to have to split it into two, Keith, to be honest. I'm going to have to do 1 to 50 and then 51 to 101.
Okay.
Number of reasons why. From a sales point of view, I'll sell more. No. It's just the gauge, you know. How people find it, you know, if it's of interest. But I try to do it in a year, but if you think about it, that's two sessions a week,
right?
And it's just impossible. So it's took us a lot longer. So I think I'm going to break it down into you know, 50 and then get it published. But when, I just don't know. It's really exciting because it's a passion project. And I have a bit of a shiny thing syndrome because I tend to start a lot of these things. So I really wanted to kick this business on this year. I mentioned before that I've moved offices and, you know, we're bringing new people in. So my focus is really on this business right now.
Right.
Once I've got through this little stage of growth, I'll then start doubling down on the volunteering again when the pandemic lifts a bit.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I mean, if there is anything we can do to support that and, you know, obviously let us know, because I'm sure there's a few PR agencies out there who'd be interested in finding out a little bit more about it as well.
Well, I'll just give you one challenge. I think it was a 9-hour podcast live stream.
Wow.
So with about, I don't know, 16 guests or something back to back.
Oh, my God.
So try that. It's a good laugh.
A podcast-a-thon type thing.
Yeah, it was good.
Oh, my God. I mean, I have trouble with an hour, you know, but 9 hours, my God.
I was punch drunk because, you know, you're trying to like talk to different people about different subjects. It just was tough.
Oh, man. Well, congratulations. Is that available to download anywhere?
Yeah. That'll be on my YouTube. That's on my YouTube channel, actually. Yeah. And I tell you what I did in terms of batch processing. Every one of those, I chunked down into half an hour podcasts.
Oh, okay. Well, I suppose that does you for a few months worth of
yeah, exactly. Sat back.
Yeah, nice one. But all right, so just as an aside, there's was recently a piece of research where nationwide 5,000 Britons were researched to, and it revealed a heat map of the UK of what type of curry they prefer, with folks from Middlesbrough. I know that's not quite your area, but it's certainly the northeast emerging as those most partial to an extremely hot curry. And on LinkedIn, I posted up a rather lovely picture of a delicious looking curry, and 30% of those server of those 5,000 from or 30% of the people surveyed from the Northeast said they love an eye-watering curry as a like a vindaloo or something else like that, compared to like the national average of just 16%. So I mean, obviously, I don't want to go into any stereotypes here, but I've got to ask: curry? Do you like a hot curry?
I love a hot curry. I've got a funny hot curry story. Do you want to hear it?
Go on, go for it.
So India is one of my favorite places to visit, and my parents have been going for about 20 years to Goa. So 2 years ago, I took my pals to Goa. There was three of us went over. We flew from Manchester, and we got on the beach, and we had a few beers on the beach, as you do. And along the beach, they've got shacks, which are just small restaurants, if you like, but they're on, you know, they're on the sand. And the guy come over, and of course, three Geordies. Right, mate, we'll have your hottest curry. Well, of course, in India, and especially in Goa, they don't really eat hot stuff. It's a stereotype. They don't, you know, it's they want to taste it, and they don't really like the hot, spicy stuff. So this guy looked at us and he said, oh, hot? I mean, how hot do you want it? Way vindaloo, mate, obviously. So this guy brings the curry. Of course, we all eat this curry, and then we're like, the guy said, well, how was it? You know, that the chef put lots of curry and lots of spices in. We're like, no, that wasn't hot at all, mate. Next day, we went back to the same shack on the beach. We're like, right, okay, come on, have it double the strength of that, right? God. So every day we went, it wasn't hot enough.
What's
for it.
Going on,
and on his little receipt, it had like 300% spicy, 500% spicy. We've got these receipts still. We've got to remember that day when the guy was talking about 300% spicy. But yeah, we love hot food here in the Northeast. We can't get enough of it.
I wonder if that's got something to do with the weather as well, whether that kind of helps it. But so, I mean, I was going to ask you, but I guess you've probably already been able to answer that one. I mean, what for you, what's the ideal conditions for eating a curry?
Conditions, what, in terms of restaurant or?
Yeah, where would you rather be? If you were going to have a curry, what would you do? At home,
yeah.
In a restaurant?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to be on the Goa beach right now in India with my parents. That would be amazing. In South Shields, we've got a place called Ocean Road, and it's just one long road of restaurants. And actually, they're all Bangladeshis. There was quite a lot of Bangladeshi people, families settled here.
Lovely.
It's amazing. And we've got our favorite restaurant on the Ocean Road, and we'll go in there, and it's got to be mixed kebab, right?
Lovely.
Keema rice.
Yep.
Chicken tikka vindaloo.
Ooh, okay.
Keema naan. All the poppadoms, all the pickles.
Lovely.
And a pint of cobra.
Lovely. Now you're talking. Ice cold cobra beer. Lovely. All right. Now you got me going. That's fantastic. And that's the first time we've covered that subject, but I think that's great, because everybody's got a curry opinion, haven't they, in the UK? It's funny. But so now we're going to get on to the show that sort of makes all the pain of answering all the other questions so worthwhile. And let's just assume a freshman tells you they're starting a new business. What's the one piece of advice you'd give them?
Just do it. That's it. You know the Nike stripe, yep. The Nike strap line that I love. This is 30 years old, which encompasses race, gender, abilities, everything. Just do it, because we don't need the trinkets. You don't need that Versace jacket. You don't need that posh car. You know, all those posh shoes, or the Omega watch, or the latest iPhone. You don't need all them things. Just bootstrap. Okay, don't borrow a load of money. Don't go into debt for stuff. Just bootstrap and get it done. That's it.
Lovely. Great advice. Good advice. But, okay, so now you're obviously a very motivated person, quite clearly. But, I mean, do you ever shut off completely? I mean, if so, how do you wind down?
There's a whole podcast in here, Keith, because I talk a lot about mental health and burnout quite a lot. Uh-huh. as leaders, because I've burnt out three times, hospitalized, scans, cameras down the throats, ultrasounds, chest x-rays, popping beta blockers for fun during meetings.
Oh my God.
To push through. And that's why I'm really strong about culture right now. That's why I'm really passionate about culture, because I've had a horrible culture. But for me, in terms of winding down, I don't like to sit. I can't sit. But running for me is lovely, because it files the day off. It gives me a chance to think. So when I'm running alone, I'm just putting things in boxes and just kind of filing off the whole day and you know, puzzling things
off.
Out
that's
in my mind.
That's a great expression. Just takes the edges off the day. That's fantastic. Great.
Do you not get that? You said you were a runner. Do you not feel if you haven't ran for a while, you get a little bit fidgety and a bit jittery?
It's the weirdest thing, because my natural condition is not to be fit. All right. I've spent 40 years of my life being unfit. And I was kind of just naturally a thin person anyway, so I never thought it bothered me. You know, I never thought I needed to be fit. And then I woke up on my 50th birthday and I was suddenly it looked like I was looking over the top of a pile of laundry, you know. And I thought, right, okay, I need to do this. And it's funny now because I exercise probably every other day. I mean, I'll do sort of 3 or 4 miles. But it's weird because I'm now starting to feel guilty if I don't do it, which is odd, because I never thought that I would ever, you know, I thought my body would always like say, yeah, now you're fine for another few days, you'll be okay. But it's true. It's amazing how that happens. But now we've got the last three here is you recommended a cracking piece of music, and this is I asked you a track that you would shush Her Majesty up to listen to, and you know, and so what is it and why?
It's Nirvana and Breed, isn't it? You got that one?
Fantastic track.
When I start my keynotes, obviously, you know, people walk out with a keynote and it's all this like high, kind of like nicey, kind of like poppy, kind of, you know, so, and then I rock in with Nirvana and everyone's like, oh my, who is this? and I walked out, it's my walkout song when I got in the ring as well. So yeah, I love Nirvana. I like being a bit.
Lovely.
Bit rough,
well,
isn't it?
Yeah, nice bit of grunge is always good. And you sent me the link, and I watched the video again, and it's nice to see Dave Grohl looking so lean and fresh in those days in that video. It's fantastic. Do you follow him now? Do you follow Dave Grohl?
Nah, not at all. Kurt was my man.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, understand. Yeah. Understand. But books. Let's get on to books, because I think you've got quite an interesting alternative here. So one for pleasure and one for leisure, right?
I picked On the Road by Jack Kerouac. You know, the Beat Generation, which is really something quite magical about that time, you know, kind of free and easy. And Jack... In the book, it's actually kind of based on a true story. The guys travel across America and, you know, they jump on the carts on the back of trains. You see on the movies where the sliding doors, they jump on them and they go from state to state and they just experience life with no real pressures or anything. And I love that concept, and I get lost in those books. I love travel books. There's a lovely one called Shantaram as well, and it's based in India as well. Traveling through India. So yeah, I love those travel books. I kind of get lost in those.
And so travel books in terms of fiction or just sort of the geographical side of things.
Yeah, the geographical side. Actually, Shantaram is based on a true story. It's a really interesting one, and it's about a gentleman who just has an amazing life. He escapes from prison for dealing drugs. He ends up in Bollywood movies. He becomes a bouncer for Bollywood stars, and he gets put back in jail again, and he ends up living in the Bombay slums as a doctor just because he had a first aid kit in his bag one day for a couple of years. And it's based on a true story, actually. And I think they're trying to make a movie, and I think Johnny Depp was lined up to make it, but it never came off, I don't think. Just being lost in those books, you can actually hear the noise, you can smell the things and everything, you know.
Oh, lovely. That's a great recommendation, because everybody's now living with a bookcase behind them, and I noticed that you're not short of a background yourself there. You've actually got quite a nice little setup there, but most people like to have a little bookshelf behind them, and we're putting all these books up on a bookshelf. Might actually give them away for some. Might get the, actually go and buy them and give them away for someone at some day. So, but thanks very much for that.
Well, hang on. Let me just tell you about... So in my park, people put them in polythene bags and leave them on a bench for people.
Oh, you have okay. So it's like an informal library.
Yeah, to try that.
That's a good idea. So we should do that, a virtual version of that. Pass a book on.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Good idea. I'll come back to you on that one. And finally, Ian, what three words? Three words. You know the geographical locator tool. What three words? So just pick three words that would identify you.
I can't swear on this, can I?
Yeah, you can. Say whatever you
can
want.
Can I? Well, on a Monday, we have a 9:30 meeting, and it's a GSD meeting, and it's Get Shit Done.
Okay. Oh, well, I have to call you on that. We've already had Get Shit Done.
Okay. So we have a meeting, and it's all about that, and I love that because that's what it kind of epitomises, just getting it done. And just like the Nike strap line, just do it, you know. That's what we just have a go at it, you know. So I've got to change the three.
Yeah.
Can I not have just do it? It's been trademarked.
Oh, you
I guess.
You could have that. Yeah. You could have that.
Can I pinch that?
Yeah.
Can I pinch
okay. that? Well, okay. So we've got Get Shit Done. That was Vanessa Green who had that. But
oh, was it?
Yeah. And you're going to have just do it.
Mm.
Fine. Okay. That's great. Sounds good. Sounds good. Ian, you're on time as well. Did it fantastic. You're right on the nail. That was fantastic timing wise. So thank you very much, and I hope that I hope this has been as much fun for you as it was for me. I really enjoyed talking to you, and I love the idea of this book. So as I say, anything we can do to help that, then let me know. And if people want to get hold of you, what's the easiest way that they can reach you?
I'm a huge Twitter fan. Okay. I absolutely love Twitter. I'm not on Snapchat, and well, I am really, but you know, I don't use it, or TikTok, but Twitter for me. So it's Ian_Farrer. Or you could jump onto the podcast, the Industry Angel Business Podcast. You mentioned that, and thanks for that. Yeah,
good stuff. All right, and obviously LinkedIn is another channel. Do you use it much? Or
I'm on it every day. I am a massive fan of LinkedIn. And good. Actually, if you want to see what books are on my shelf right now, you can go to my latest post and you'll see a picture of my bookcase.
Lovely. Fantastic. Well, there you go. Well, Ian, it's fantastic to talk to you. Thank you so much for putting some time aside, and you've been an absolute really good sport, and I hope that we can pick this up again really soon, and maybe when you've got the book out we can do it again. But in the meantime, just remains for me to say thank you so much. You take care, stay safe, and I look forward to seeing you again soon. All the best.
Thank you, Keith, and thanks everyone for listening.
Bye bye. And as Ian pogos and air guitars off into the distance, I'd like to thank him and his colleague Misha for putting a large amount of time aside to get this interview fixed and recorded. Thank you very much. I always come away from these chats a little more enlightened than when I went in, but Ian really does walk the talk when it comes to personal branding, and I think he's really onto something. If you've got any doubts about the future of broadcast to create standout, just follow his What Three Words advice and just do it. My thanks also to Team Fuel, that's co-producer Donna, the band The Prospectors, and our vital IT support provided by the kindly folk at Queegee Bow Design in downtown Indianapolis, USA. So join us next time on The Fuel, sponsored by The Advertist, the new business development platform for the new business curious. And really, shouldn't that include you?